Welcome to this week's teaching from Exchange Church in the heart of Belfast.
I've really enjoyed church over the last few weeks, but that sounds like I haven't been enjoying it beforehand. But I think for me, the big thing is God's presence, isn't it? And actually just getting together and being in God's presence and encountering God. That's the heart of it all, isn't it? That's, if we don't have that, we're the poorest people in the world. If it's just about words, getting together and just learning stuff, then without the presence of God, then what's the point, I would argue? Because it's his presence that makes the feast, the Bible says. It's his presence, it's being in him, with him that makes all the difference. And we've been talking about grace stories, and I want to talk today about whenever grace meets law. And if you've been coming to this church, you know, you'll think, here we go again, another talk about law and grace and so on. And then if you thought that wasn't enough, I've heard that all before, we're going to go to John chapter 3. Oh my word. You know, many times if you read that, it's not one of those obscure passages, but actually it's so good. And there's a very good reason why it's probably the most popular and well-known passage in the Bible. So it's just, we'll kick straight into reading John chapter 3. And we're going to read from verse 1 through to verse 10. See, the monitor's not working, so I'm going to have to turn around. Now, there was a Pharisee, a man named Nicodemus, who was a member of the Jewish ruling council. That's the Sanhedrin in some translations. He came to Jesus at night and said, Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher who has come from God, for no one could perform the signs you're doing if God were not with him. Jesus replied, Very truly, I tell you. That was the old King James who said, Verily, verily. I used to love that. Very truly, I tell you, no one can see the kingdom of God unless they are born again. How can someone be born when they are old? Nicodemus asked. Surely they cannot enter a second time into their mother's womb to be born. Jesus answered, Very truly, I tell you, no one can enter the kingdom of God unless they are born of water and the Spirit. Flesh gives birth to flesh, but the Spirit gives birth to spirit. You should not be surprised at my saying, you must be born again. The wind blows where it pleases. You hear its sound, but you cannot tell where it comes from or where it is going. So it is with everyone born of the Spirit. How can this be? Nicodemus asked. You're Israel's teacher, said Jesus, and you do not understand these things. I can remember as a Sunday school kid, Cookstown Baptist Church, learning John chapter 3, verses 1, right through to verse 20, and getting off by heart, and in the King James Version as well, and you know, getting whatever stickers on a chart and a little certificate to prove it. I think I was probably about 8 years old. That's the sort of upbringing, and it's ingrained in my head that in the King James Version. But we're really familiar with stuff, and sometimes when we're really familiar with stuff, we can skim over some of the nice little bits of detail in it, can't we? And even here, that what really strikes me is the bit that Jesus says to Nicodemus at the end. He says, you're Israel's teacher and you don't get it. How often we think we see people and we assume that you get it, and we think about ourselves, we think, I've got this nailed. Anybody ever live and they think, I've been a Christian a long time, I've got this sort of grace thing sorted out, and then something happens. Well, God speaks something to your life and go, I haven't quite got it yet. Phil, have you seriously haven't quite got this? You mean, you talk about grace, but do you ever actually really live this thing? Do you know what it's really like? See, Nicodemus was a senior Pharisee, okay? And we all use that word, we threw that word out a lot. You know, he was successful, in inverted commas. He was successful as far as the Jewish nation was concerned. He was rich. If you read about Nicodemus, it suggests that in some of the antiquities that we read that he was probably one of the three richest people in Jerusalem. He was minted. He was rich. He was righteous. He was a Pharisee. He followed the rules and to meticulous detail, and he prided himself as that. And there, as a consequence of that, he was very well respected. Okay, I didn't mean to put 3 R's there, but I just realized what I said. So he's rich, righteous, and respected in his own eyes. So that's what he had. And so he was, if you like, everything that society, the Jewish society, would have looked up to and said, that's what you need to be like. I want to be like him. And under the cover of darkness, for very good reasons that he didn't want to be seen, he comes at night to meet with Jesus. And he says, Jesus, you've got something. And he was well-intentioned. Sometimes, you know, I think we realize that what we'll see is a lot of ourselves, I think, and people like Nicodemus and the Pharisees, because the Pharisees wanted to be righteous. They really wanted, but their intentions were very misplaced. Okay? And he wanted to learn more. But fundamentally, when we talk about grace meeting law, Nicodemus represented everything that the Jewish people and religion held as this is what you need to be successful. And he comes to Jesus and says, there's something more. What is it? And I would suggest that he's probably come there and said, what else do I need? What other information do I need? What else do I need to do? What are you going to bring and tell me and let me know about? And he represented, if you like, the gospel of works. And the gospel of works is this. God really dislikes you, and you got to work really hard to get into his good books. Okay? It's a bit like Andrew said, he's there pointing a finger going, you're not good enough. You have to live up to this certain standard. And if you live up to this standard, you might just get into my good books. If whenever I do the ready reckoner of the day and of your life, what goes in the plus column and the negative column, and if you end up in a balance of positive things and good works, then you might just squeeze into my good books and you might get blessing. And that is the gospel of works over and over and over again. And the Pharisees saw themselves as the most accurate interpretation of the law and therefore the most righteous people. See, you've got to try really hard on the gospel of works for God to like you. Isn't that a weird thing to be? Does anybody here try really hard for people to like them at all? Or for God to like you? That's our default, isn't it? We try hard to be liked. And we think that if God, therefore, default is that he doesn't like us, we try even harder to get into his good books. Anybody ever had any disagreements or arguments in a family, be that with your spouse? So I've heard that people have those sorts of things. I don't know what it's like. Children, perhaps. There. Did you ever do that thing then whenever something happens and then you're super nice to get back into the good books? Yeah. Does anybody ever feel like sometimes with God we're constantly being super nice just to try to get into his good books? Isn't it so much easier whenever you don't feel like you have to get into somebody's good books at home in any relationship? That you can just be. You can just have a bit of crack. You can enjoy each other's company. You can enjoy a relationship. And you're not feeling like you're working hard to measure up to this thing. Oh, yeah. No. Is anybody, like, I'm only speaking from what I've heard. Yeah, right. But have that thing, we have a bit of a disagreement with somebody or an issue, and then you go a bit cold, and you think, I'm just going to punish you by not responding to you in the way that I know you want me to respond. Yeah, anybody ever do that? So I'm going to be that wee bit colder. You're going to have to work that little bit harder. And I'm just going to remind you that you really annoyed me. Yeah. And I'm just going to do that. So you're going to have to work really hard. And I'm just going to be a little bit cool and a wee bit removed. Yeah. It's amazing how we view God like that too. You think God is like that? I'm just going to keep you at arm's length, Phil. I'm not going to bless you today because you didn't read your Bible yesterday. You behaved in that way and did this and this and this. So therefore, I'm just going to be a wee bit cool with you. And you're going to have to work extra specially hard. And then I might just throw you a crumb of blessing. It's amazing how we think of God like that. Because we, you know, it's that old famous saying around Blaise Pascal, I think said, God created us in his image and we decided to return the favor, you know? And the God of our own image is just as self-centered and prickly and hard to please as we are, you know? But I'm really glad that he's not. Because Jesus then comes face to face with this as a mindset. And so we see Jesus as grace meeting law, Nicodemus as the representative of law. And the Pharisees and Jesus had a lot of run-ins. And they placed this yoke on the shoulders of the people. And that Jesus came actually to show a whole new, better way of life. And I've got a hemmed and hawed about whether or not to read this because it's pretty long, but I'm going to read it anyway, all right? But it's out of the Message Bible, and it's Matthew 23. I've redacted it slightly just for time's sake. But Matthew 23, verses 13 through to 32, I'm not going to read every last bit of it, but this is Jesus in plain language telling the Pharisees what he thought about them, yeah? And it's pretty good stuff, you know? It's pretty direct. I've had it with you. You're hopeless, you religion scholars, you Pharisees, frauds. Your lives are roadblocks to God's kingdom and you refuse to enter and won't let anyone else enter. You're hopeless, you religious scholars and Pharisees, frauds. You go halfway around the world to make a convert, but once you get him, you make him into a replica of yourselves, double damned. Anybody ever go and meet a church? And I can remember, you know, come on, brother, you need to be saved. You're going to a fiery pit of hell. And then you get people saved, and then you turn them into as big a risen, more baggage. God loves you no matter what. Get saved, just receive him, put your hand up in a meeting, then you'll have it. And then when you're in, now here's all the rest of the baggage. Yeah. Anybody have an upbringing or life like that experience? Northern Ireland? Never. You're hopeless. With what arrogant stupidity. You say, if someone makes a promise with his fingers crossed, that's nothing. But if he swears with his hand on the Bible, that's serious. What ignorance. What does the leather on the Bible carry more weight than the skin in your hands? A promise is a promise. What difference does it make if you make a promise inside or outside a house of worship? A promise is a promise. God is present, watching, and holding to your account, regardless. You're hopeless, you religious scholars and Pharisees, frauds. You keep meticulous account books, tithing on every nickel and dime you get, but on the meat of God's law, the things like fairness and compassion and commitment, the absolute basics, you carelessly take it or leave it. Careful bookkeeping is commendable, but the basics are required. Do you have any idea how silly you look writing a life story that's wrong from start to finish, nitpicking over commas and semicolons? This is Jesus speaking to the Pharisees. You're hopeless, you religious scholars and Pharisees, frauds. You burnish the surface of your cups and bowls so they sparkle in the sun while the insides are maggoty with your greed and gluttony. Stupid Pharisees, scar the insides and then the gleaming surface will mean something. You're hopeless, you religious scholars and Pharisees. Frauds, you're like manicured grave plots, grass clipped and the flowers bright, but 6 feet down, it's all rotting bones and worm-eaten flesh. People look at you and think you're saints, but beneath the skin, you're total frauds. You're hopeless, you religious scholars and Pharisees. Frauds, you build granite tombs for your prophets and marble monuments for your saints, and you say that if we had lived in the days of your ancestors, no blood would have been on your hands. You protest too much. You're cut from the same cloth as those murderers and daily add to the death count. Snakes, reptilian snakes. Do you think you can worm your way out of this? Never have to pay the piper? It's on account of people like you I send prophets and wise guides and scholars generation after generation and generation after generation. You treat them like dirt, greeting them with lynch mobs, hounding them with abuse. That's what Jesus had to say to the religious leaders of his day. Is it any wonder he ended up on a cross? These boys wanted rid of him. It's pretty direct stuff. It's known if you look at, traditional translations of the Bible, those are the seven woes of Jesus to the Pharisees in Matthew 23. Your snakes, a brood of vipers, how will you escape being condemned to hell, is what it says in the NIV version and all of that. So Jesus spoke directly, yet we have one of their leaders coming to Jesus and said, tell me more. Can you get the how far apart Jesus' teaching and these guys' view of the world was? Because they saw themselves as having better knowledge following the rules. They valued the rich over the poor. Being rich and having stuff was a measure of God's blessing. Anybody recognize any of this? Being sick was a consequence either of your sin or your parents' sin. Remember, whenever Jesus healed the man and said, look at you, sure you're, the Pharisee said, sure you're a son of hell, like you knew you're evil from your birth. He says, no, this is so I could show how glorious I am here. So they related sickness to that. They thought that by associating with the right people, you would be righteous. God listens to me, but he won't listen to you. If you work harder and give lots of stuff, God's going to bless you. That was their whole frame of reference. Do this, get that. You are what you do. Yeah. And what you do is more important than who you are. That's the whole framework of life. Do you want me to tell you something about religion and about law? It makes you really self-righteous. You become self-righteous because if you have to measure yourself how good you are, you tend to measure yourself against other people. And it's an accusation that the church has been leveled at the door of the church for years, isn't it? How can you possibly say that you're going to heaven and other people aren't? You're self-righteous. Look at you. You think you know it all, and you don't know it all. Yeah? And we get called self-righteous all the time. But that's a sort of a conventional religious legalism. It's self-righteousness. You're as good as your actions. What you do is who you are. And ultimately, what religion says and law says is that my security, my identity, my purpose and hope relies on my ability to adhere to a set of rules, laws, suppositions, or accepted norms in order to be regarded as good, worthy, and accepted. I'm going to read that again, okay? My security, identity, purpose, and hope relies on my ability to adhere to a set of rules, laws, suppositions, or accepted norms in order to be regarded as good, worthy, and accepted. Does that sound familiar? Does anybody ever see anything just maybe approaching that outside the church? That your security, identity, and purpose, hope relies on you adhering to some set of rules and laws and norms and ways of thinking so that people think you're good, worthy, and accepted? We level legalism at the door of religion and at the door of the church, but I would say that we navigate laws and rules all the time. And then there is a new legalism afoot in the world. And it's not a religious legalism, but it's a legalism of the masses. It's a legalism of the loudest voices. It's lots of little pockets of legalism that have their own laws. A new orthodoxy, as Andrew says, around this is what we do and this is how you live. And you ascribe to this set of rules, laws, suppositions, behave in this way, that way. You will be accepted by the group of people, and therefore you will be of value. It's not religious. It's not a set of laws that's written in a religious text, but it's just as real and legalistic as it was for those Pharisees. Just as real. Some laws are obvious and good. Laws of the land, rules of engagement, contractual obligations, all of those things. Fine, but we live and operate by social norms and accepted patterns of behavior that ultimately tell us, do more, work harder, get stuff. Do this, get that. Sound familiar? Think a certain way, present a certain version of yourself, and as long as you do that, regardless of what's going on inside, then it's all good. Present this caring, happy, affluent version of yourself, work hard, and you will find salvation. Maybe not in a cross, but in a cause or a group or in a people. That makes sense? See, I used to think Phariseeism was, if that's a word, was all about works. Was all about a preoccupation with laws and rules and principles and these trivial details of religious observance about you could only walk a mile and doing all of these things. That they didn't understand that actually they just need to be justified by faith alone, and all they needed to do was stop that and trust God. But I realize that's not the main issue, because the main issue is how they viewed themselves in relation to God and how they viewed God. And there's a very important difference, and that's where Jesus comes in and comes at it from a very different angle. And that's why it just couldn't compute for Nicodemus. Didn't get it. It was so far removed from that. They fell into this default thinking that doing stuff or being a certain thing would solve the issue. But the issue was way bigger than they appreciated. The issue wasn't that they had to do stuff. The issue was that they were fundamentally separated from God, and you can never earn it from God. Their understanding of who God was as an angry God who disliked them, that they had to earn his approval, was so far away from it. And that's at the heart of it. It's not about being preoccupied with doing stuff. That's the symptom. That's the effect. But the culprit or the root of it was their view of God and their relationship to God. But we live in a world with a newfound and a new kind of self-righteousness. Anybody find there's a real self-righteousness about it at the minute? We see it in the media. We see it all the time. The haves and the have-nots, those with the knowledge who understand things, those within a certain group. And what I see is lots of self-important, superior people looking down their noses at others, either from a political system other voters, other viewpoints, people from certain backgrounds, people from certain places, people who think and do certain things. Because the natural endpoint when it's about what you do will always be what? Self-righteousness. That I'm right and you're wrong. When your identity, self-worth, and future depends on what you do, you will always surround yourself with those who echo you and reinforce that those who aren't like you are not as good as you. You need people to reinforce your sense of self and confirm that you are good and accepted, while other people are wrong, uncouth, unsophisticated, and at best to be pitied. We've seen it in the press recently, have we? A new brand of intolerance that comes out where this vociferous trolling of people online via Twitter or whatever it might be, where we create GIFs and memes and say stuff about people that you would never in a million years think of saying to someone face to face. But it's okay. Because it depersonalizes people to what they do rather than who they are. You get that? They're depersonalized. So I can say whatever I like to you. You read of people, like it's some stuff I'm not going to repeat up here, but you read of people like, you know, female politicians who've made stances about things and all these guys saying what they're going to do to them. It's ridiculous. Would you ever say that to someone? People who have made certain mistakes in life and people just jump on it. We read about kids taking their own lives because of trolling and stuff that happens that we would never accept face to face. But I'm part of this group. You're not like me. I get self-righteous. I depersonalize you. So it's not actually the person that I'm against. It's a system and a things. And I inflate myself and deflate or depersonalize you. They do X, therefore they are Y. They vote for Donald Trump. Oh, therefore they are. They are pro-Brexit. Therefore, they are. They are anti-Brexit. Therefore, they are. Yeah. We can keep going. And you can think of lots of things. Those are just really obvious things. People look, why is our society so separated? I would argue this is the reason why. It's the new legalism. It's a new brand of intolerance. Where tolerance in itself has become intolerant. Because unless I subscribe to the new orthodoxy, then I'm deemed as being intolerant. Of tolerance. But tolerance by definition, if I met Andrew someday and said, well, you know, Andrew, what sort of guy is? Oh, he's tolerable. What would you think of your thoughts of Andrew? Yeah. Or what's it like spending, I'm just picking on Andrew because he's front and he can take it. But he said, what's it like spending a day with Andrew? Yeah, I tolerate it. Or sitting through one of Andrew's sermons, or one of Phil's, you tolerate it. Yeah. What does that imply? You don't necessarily like it, but you tolerate it. But the definition of tolerance today is not that. Tolerance has been redefined as, I love it, I think it's amazing. Your view is different to mine, and I think that your view is great. That's not tolerance. Yeah. So the tolerance, the new tolerance, is intolerance. It's become intolerant. Why? Because we're trying to define ourselves by what we do, and it is the new brand of legalism, and it is law in a different cloak. Where one act or a series of acts can define who you are and whether or not you're accepted in the new legalism. Where hard work results-driven mindset. And do you know what? It is really hard work to try and do that. Isn't it mad that we live in a world where one statement made 15 years ago can end someone's career? Would anybody here love every statement you've ever made in the last 20 years to be examined? Yeah, Andrew's going, please, God, no. Yeah. Do you know, you see these things. This person posted something on Twitter 10 years ago. Therefore, they're not of the appropriate character to do that. I would guarantee the people saying that they're not of appropriate character, let's go through everything you've ever said or written, and let's see if you measure up to it. But isn't it amazing, this self-righteousness and intolerance that we see at every level? Because the problem is you can never fully live up to everything, which will result inevitably in greater angst and greater self-condemnation and greater judgment from others. Because it always ends in judgment. Law always ends in judgment and self-condemnation. It's the end point of it all. whether it is traditional religious legalism or the new orthodoxy and religion. Rather than looking for it in religious law, the new legalism looks for acceptance, self-worth, and significance in a whole range of different activities. In fact, lots of people have written about this, about where we look for self-worth. And a group of authors, Crocker et al., 2003, wrote about these 35 items that measure self-worth, and they organized them into seven different categories or domains. First thing is where we look for self-worth, and we tend to look at it, and you'll see it here, is approval from others. That's the first place we look. So whatever the group deems important, do that. Whatever the values are of the norms are here, whatever it is, do that, and then you will derive your own self-worth and meaning from that. Your physical appearance, your looks, body shape, whatever fillers you've done, an ability to frown, whatever it might be, how you look, and there is a look now, isn't there? You look into different groups and different parts of society, and if you have a certain look, you're accepted in that because you derive self-worth from your looks. Approval of others, physical appearance, outdoing others in competition. Be that position, power, can be simple and subtle, or it can be big and brash, but about one-upmanship. Academic competence, being smarter, more educated, those uneducated, uncouth individuals, they don't understand it, so we'll just give them a Bible and there's a self-righteousness that comes with it, but I find worth in the fact that I've got a couple of degrees. Family love and support. Being virtuous or a moral person as defined by the virtues and morals of the tribe that you belong to. Yeah? And actually, the seventh one is the place you might find self-worth is in God's love. Interestingly, that in this, secular scientific, psychological literature, that's what they're saying, those seven domains. Bottom line is, if I do this, all will be good. But the problem is, you can never always live up to it because you'll not always be perfectly accepted by everybody. You'll not necessarily look the right way. You'll not necessarily have the right stuff. There's always people who will have more than you. And the problem with that is that when the way we want to see ourselves doesn't line up with what is actually going on with our lives, then our whole self-image and life is threatened. And that is the real cause of angst, anxiety, and uncertainty that makes us fall into this thing of self-condemnation. Work harder, try harder, get more in order to achieve that because I'm not getting there. And so we see lots of people burnt out, worn out. And to cope with the threat, we try to compensate for the discrepancy between what we are and what we want to be. And we compensate it by working harder and seeking out specific things and activities to repair our feelings of self-worth. An interesting study was done in the 80s. It's published in the journal Basic and Applied Social Psychology, where they looked at MBA students. It's fascinating. And they said those students who lacked success relative to their peers in terms of their grades or their job offers, what did they do? They tended to use more products that signaled success. So they went out to wear more luxury brands, watches carry designer briefcases, and attempt to compensate for feeling unsuccessful. They wanted to make themselves look successful. But they then discovered, the researchers, that when people tried to prove themselves worthy, listen, when you try to prove yourself worthy, you're more likely to dwell on your shortcomings. When you try to prove yourself worthy, what happens is you focus on your shortcomings. When you live under law and try to be this, it ends up being self-condemnation. We see it in church. We see it in religion. We see it in the new orthodoxy. We see it in life and society. We see it everywhere. It's a default position. Because an individual's main priority in life is to find acceptance of self and by others. And then Jesus comes to Nicodemus, who's just the same. The same mindset, the same thing that makes him tick, saying, I've got all of these things. I'm the main man. I've got all the money. I've ticked all the religious boxes. I've got all of these things. Well, how's he feeling? I'm never quite good enough. Because the more you focus on doing stuff, the more you focus on your inadequacies. He comes to Jesus, and Jesus blows it all out of the water and comes at it from a completely different perspective and offers a whole new solution that doesn't play by the same rules. He goes way past what you do to who you are. And that's the heart of the gospel. That's the heart of Jesus for us all. That's the message that we have for society. That's the message that God has for you today. The answer is not in doing more or doing different things, but as Jesus says here, in a complete restart, in a reboot, in a rebirth, in that well-worn, overused, baggage-laden phrase, being born again. We're afraid to use that at times, aren't we? Because it comes with so much baggage. You're born again, brother. But Jesus, whenever he said this, it wasn't the well-worn phrase. He said, you need a rebirth. I prefer rebirth because it doesn't carry the same baggage, same thing. But Jesus said, you need to be born from above. Is actually the translation of the Greek. You need to be born from above. You need to have the source of your life changed, transferred, not from what you do outside, but a rebirth that starts within at the very deepest part of who you are. Not the external, because do you know what? You know what's interesting about Jesus' interaction with Nicodemus? He doesn't deal with the external stuff at all. He doesn't even go there. He doesn't mention it. He doesn't mention works at any time. He doesn't mention what he has or what he needs to do. Yet that is everything that Nicodemus focused on in his life. He goes right past it. Jesus doesn't judge the external. Why? Because that's not the place to find the answers. So it's not where his focus is. Because it's at the core of your very existence. And Jesus threw this in and Nicodemus couldn't compute. Because he had in his head what a good, righteous, godly man would look like and a picture that he, by his whole system of life, had promoted aggressively in the entire culture of the day. If you had an ordered life and behaved in a certain way and you worked assiduously to present yourself as righteous, but Jesus looked at him and went, that doesn't fool me. Let's get to the core of the issue because it's right at the heart. It's not what you do, it's who you are. That's the same message today. And Jesus doesn't even go down the works path, which I love. He shows another way. And the starting point is perhaps the most famous verse in the whole Bible that Jesus comes to then. In verse 16, the same discourse with Nicodemus. And we all know it, don't we? John 3:16. It's, for God so loved. Oh, that's your starting point. Your starting point is not, what have you done? I was going, today to make you feel proud. I nearly came into my head there for whatever reason. Oh, man. Where did that come from? do it again. No. It wasn't what you've done today, yesterday, in your life, what you have. Let's just blow all that stuff. Your starting point is not what tribe you belong to or what you have. Your starting point is for God. So loved. So loved the world that he gave his one and only son. That whoever, not the people who meet the certain criteria, not the people that live in this little world, not the people who are part of your tribe, not the people that you look down your nose at, or the people who are the same as you, but whoever does what? What do I need to do? Believe in him, won't perish, and they'll have eternal life. Whoa, hang on, Jesus. I've been knocking my pan in every day trying to earn acceptance. I've been doing all this stuff with the minutia of the law, and I've always seen you as being angry with me, and I'm trying to earn your acceptance. And hang on, I'm doing a full 180, and my view of God was wrong from the get-go. You're not angry with me. You love me so much, so much that you've sent your son. That's where grace meets law, in the love of God, in Jesus coming to die. It's his story. His perfect love sits outside of all of our activities, and our redemption is not contingent upon our activities, but simply on the fact that we have to receive and accept it. And this disarms and offends the most ingrained views at the core of who we are. Because that fundamentally is sin, thinking we can do it ourselves. The self-righteousness. And now Jesus, I love the next few verses. I love John 3:16, but I actually love the next couple of verses even more. Because this is Jesus' starting point. He said, for this, God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world. Did you hear that? Jesus didn't come to condemn you. Why? Because what happens when you try to live it yourself? You've condemned yourself, right? You're already condemned. But to save the world through him. Whoever believes in him is not condemned, but whoever does not believe stands condemned already. Jesus said, listen, I see you're condemned. You're gone. You're separated. You're already condemned. I'm not going to condemn you because that's a fact. Let's cut past that stuff and get the solution. How many times are churches focused on the condemning bit? How many times do we condemn ourselves? And Jesus said, I'm not condemning you because that's your situation. But look, all you got to do is believe in the name of God's one and only Son. And in him, you move from condemnation to life, this rebirth. Isn't that amazing? A different kind of life, a different rhythm that frees us from trying to earn, judge ourselves or others to a place where we're free to live from within, where we don't add up the pluses and minuses on the ready reckoner. His love rescues us, renews us, gives us new life, a new start, a new source that goes from the inside out, not what you do, but who we're in. We know this, don't we? But do we know also that it pervades all of our thinking? It pervades society. And Jesus cuts to the core again to say, it's not about what you do, it's about who he is and who you are in him. And we start again. Because God rescues us, renews us to give us a new life, to enable us to live for him in the kingdom. He has a transcendent plan for your life. God has a plan for your life that changes, therefore, because he's not angry with you, because he loves you so much, he's got a plan with your life and changes your relationship with him. He is not angry with you this morning. He loves you. He is not angry with the world. He loves it. The world is already condemned. He loves the world and he wants to reconcile the world to him. Number one, when we come to Jesus, the new life of rebirth is one that restores our relationship to God. The second part then, is that bit, it restores our relationship with ourselves. Because we're not looking for self-worth, self-identity, self-acceptance in what we do, what we look like, what we think, what we have. All of those things, but we're looking, we've already got it because God has called you his child and we have a new identity and all things are made new in him. So I am who he says I am. I read a lovely quote this week. It says, self-esteem is the reputation you have with yourself. My reputation with God is what? I'm highly favored, I'm loved, I'm his child. That's who you are in God this morning. It changes my relationship with God. It changes my relationship and understanding myself. It changes my relationship with other people. I have no right to judge he who God has died for. I will not point a finger and condemn anyone. I will love them. I will be reconciled to them. Because it's not about self-righteousness, I don't have to measure myself against other people. It's brilliant. I don't have to look it up and go, I have more than them. I'm better than them because we're all as bad as each other. It's great. Guess what? No, you're not as good as you think you are. It's great. And neither am I. And we're all as bad as each other. But in Jesus, how that changes us. So I can love and have unconditional acceptance for everybody because Jesus did. So we can turn it into this intolerance religious and slag people off for being intolerant and we're just as bad as them. But the new life, the new birth is one that changes that. So we change our relationship with God, our relationship with ourselves, our relationship with other people. And I would then argue our relationship with the whole world, society, creation, all things. That's all changed too. So we impact this world. We look after this world. We bless this world. We build this world. We develop this world. We sow into this world. Because God says, I'm giving you this world to look after, to steward, and to care for. That is the new life he offers. And it's not going to come by ticking a box and living up to some laws, something in your head, what you do, what you have. It's going to come in one place, and it's in Jesus. It's good, isn't it? I know that's real simple stuff. It's really simple stuff. But can you see how legalism, we like sometimes to think the Pharisees are the guys, you know, with the phylacteries on their head and all of the things that they did. But we see this whole new breed of Pharisaism that pervades normal life. And Jesus steps into it and says, it's just as relevant today. It mightn't look like the real religious stuff, but it's just the same today. And the same issues lie at the heart of it. If you want to live by your own laws and try to earn stuff, it always ends in self-condemnation and feeling like you're not good enough. Anybody not felt good enough in their life or not felt good enough this week on anything? When we're in God, he says, of course you're not good, but I am good enough. And I gave you it because you're not what you do. I love you because of who you are.